It's Diane Rehm. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, a feeling of relief that Hurricane Irma, although still truly terrifying, didn't do as much damage as we feared. Now, the enormous recovery ahead in both Texas and Florida. Also, a surprise and certainly confusion over whether President Trump is once again willing to join forces with congressional Democrats, this time over a possible deal on protecting the hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants brought to this country as children. Joining me to talk about business not as usual in Washington, David Vondrelli at The Washington Post. He joins us from Kansas City.
One of the most striking things about moving from Washington out to Kansas City is to discover that there are millions and millions of Americans who don't eat, sleep, and breathe politics.
Then Dr. Francis Collins, head of the National Institutes of Health.
There are 7,000 genetic diseases. Only 500 of those have treatments. We now at least theoretically have a way to go and fix those genetic problems.
He explained some of the promising advances in gene editing, regenerative medicine, and immunotherapy, and how they may be used not just to treat, but to actually cure many different kinds of diseases. First, from a studio at KCUR in Kansas City, David Vondrelli. He's a columnist with The Washington Post, former editor-at-large at Time magazine. He's also the author of a number of books, including Triangle, The Fire That Changed America. David Vondrelli, how great to talk with you again.
It's great to talk to you, Diane.
And you're now a columnist living in Kansas City, getting an eye on Washington from outside what's been called the swamp. Would you define for us the swamp?
Well, I think it's the nexus in the Washington area with satellite offices in maybe in New York and San Francisco Bay Area of lobbyists, lawyers, elected officials, contractors, consultants, all of whom have really figured out how to make the business of government extremely lucrative for them. I think it's now 7 of the 10 richest in terms of income counties in America are in the Beltway ring of Maryland and Virginia. So that's become the greatest industry, you know, by that measure in the country. So one of the great industries of the world is the navigating of American government. I think that's what people mean by the swamp, the sense that even though they may be arguing about policy in Washington, at the same time, this business is bipartisan and almost unmovable.
Well, then tell me about the perspective you feel you get from Kansas City on the so-called swamp.
Well, it's a couple of things. First, one of the most striking things about moving from Washington out to Kansas City is to discover that there are millions and millions of Americans who don't eat, sleep, and breathe politics, who have lives that are mostly concerned with other subjects, which when we lived in Washington, you know, we were completely absorbed by politics 24/7. But when they do engage with politics out here, it's oftentimes as an impediment or a source of difficulty for them. Kansas City is a very small business-oriented place. We have a few great companies headquartered here, but mostly it's smaller companies in manufacturing, services, agriculture. And so their experience of government is frequently in terms of red tape. in terms of a hot issue out here that was probably little noticed in Washington was an effort by the EPA to extend the Clean Water Act to regulate farm ponds. This would have, really sort of altered the experience of life for farmers. It was incredibly unpopular, and it reflected, I think, for people in rural America, the idea that, these folks from Washington don't understand their lives and yet want to intrude into them.
So here I sit in the midst of the swamp, watching as Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, for example, have a dinner with the president, come out and announce that they've reached some sort of agreement on DACA. The president then tweets that there is no such deal. What do you make of that, first of all? And second of all, if those living in Kansas City are paying any attention?
I think that was a bold move. Senator Schumer and Representative Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, former Speaker, to claim that they had the full deal. And I think after last week when they made that deal on the debt ceiling and President Trump got such acclaim for that and it was so popular, I think maybe they thought if they just claimed a deal and people started applauding again that he'd go along with it. Immigration is probably going to be a tougher road to hoe than the debt ceiling. But people are paying attention, and people like it. I think one mistake that is made by a lot of folks in Washington is thinking, A, that President Trump is a conservative, which he isn't. He's kind of a radical, apolitical person. And B, that he's a Republican, which he isn't. And so out here, people understand that he's apart from either party, and that's what they like about him. And so when they see him kind of put a shiv in Mitch McConnell's back and Paul Ryan's back to make a deal with the other side to get things going, that's exactly what they've been hoping for, somebody who would go to Washington and blow the whole thing up. And, it's interesting, if you look at our politics with pull the camera back a little bit, what you see is that, our last two presidents have both been people largely from outside of their party hierarchies who came from the outside promising to bring genuine change to Washington. And if you look at the results in 2016 last year, you could argue that the decisive swing vote were people who voted both for Barack Obama and Donald Trump, as hard as that is to imagine. And this is what those people were voting for. They wanted someone from outside to go to Washington and make real change.
Now, you had someone like Steve Bannon in the White House for the first few months, apparently advising and being advised by Donald Trump. So the question now, with his appearance on 60 Minutes recently with Charlie Rose, what do you make of how he is going to view his new role from the outside? What kind of influence is he going to have?
It was a remarkable interview, wasn't it?
I thought so, too.
Steve Bannon he's a great talker, for sure. And he has a number of, I think, very valid insights about the nature of the swamp, as we called it earlier, the the permanent party of Washington.
What are you talking about when you talk about the swamp? You're talking about the lobbyists and the people.
The permanent political class is represented by both parties. You're not going to drain that in 8 months. You're not going to drain it in 2 terms. This is going to take 10, 15, 20 years of relentlessly going after it.
So you win the election.
Transition. A lot of people. His larger theories, he's the guy who tries to sweep the details into a big grand unifying theory of everything. And that's where I think Mr. Bannon gets pretty mushy. He's populist one day and not the next. He's a nationalist on one issue and not the next. And I think his great appeal to President Trump was that he was able to put the Trump victory into a grand historical mythology about great arcs of history and how Donald Trump was going to be a transformational historical figure. And I think that really appealed to the president, who didn't have any of those thoughts about himself when he started out his campaign.
I think that appealed to him. You say he reminds you a lot of Newt Gingrich.
I do. You think about everything from how quickly they talk and how facile they are with words, all the way up to their, you know, sort of half-baked historical allusions and their, you know, I mean, I remember being with Newt Gingrich 20 years ago when he was going on and on and on about some theory of Heidi and Alvin Toffler about, you know, the grand scheme, currents of history. And he was always putting small things into these vast contexts. And Bannon has some of that as well.
Now, let's go back a little bit, because I want to ask you about the firing of the FBI director, James Comey, which, of course, led to the appointment of Robert Mueller. There's an awful lot to look at there, and you have said that you believe that if he is looking into President Trump's business interests, there's going to be a lot to find.
I do. One of the interesting things that Bannon said in that interview with Charlie Rose was that he felt this was the worst, the Comey firing was the worst political mistake of modern time.
Someone said to me that you described the firing of James Comey, you're a student of history, as the biggest mistake in political history.
That would be probably, that would probably be too bombastic even for me, but maybe modern political history.
And I think he's not far off with that. There are any number of ways that President Trump could have changed FBI directors without triggering a special prosecutor. But what we know about special prosecutors is that they're scope tends to get bigger, not smaller, as they go on in office. And that's going to be especially true, I think, with President Trump, who, as we know, has vigorously resisted separating himself from his business as he's made this transition into politics. You know, he has, under a lot of pressure, finally put day-to-day responsibility for the Trump Organization in the hands of his sons. But those sons are, you know, frequent visitors to the White House. They're with him frequently. So there's no real distance between him as president and his business. They've even shared office space during the campaign. And so I don't think there's any possible way to draw a bright line between an investigation of Trump, the candidate, from the dealings of Trump, the businessman. And I think that's why he is so upset. There's a news story out this morning talking about he continues to rant and rave about Mueller. And I think it's because he's realizing that this is going to open up who knows how many closets of his life and career.
So what apparently began as an investigation into Russia connections could lead Mr. Mueller into many different avenues, all of which surround or lead to President Trump.
Well, sure. I mean, we know, for example, already that he was in negotiations to try to build a Trump Tower in Moscow.
Yes.
At the time that he started his campaign. Something like that could never possibly happen without the cooperation of the Putin government. So that right there is opens up a lot of questions about ties. He's also acknowledged in an interview with the New York Times that he has sold condominiums to Russian oligarchs, all of whom, if you are a billionaire in Russia, you are in business with Vladimir Putin. That's just the nature of the way the country rolls over there. So those deals are going to open up questions, and those are just two of the things we know about.
We haven't talked about Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. It does make me wonder about the money it's going to take to rebuild the damage done by those hurricanes, plus the idea of forcing the ouster of undocumented immigrants, many of whom in that area might be called on to help with the rebuilding.
No, I think that's a very, very acute and sharp observation. If we were to drive down into Texas or Florida and look at the folks who are working on construction crews, I think we would see a lot of first-generation immigrants, and I'm not sure that all of them would be documented immigrants. There's going to be a huge shortage of construction labor to deal with these two enormously devastating storms, the rebuilding involved. The construction trades are already, before these storms came through, desperate for labor. Every construction company owner that I talk to, and that's not a small number, talks about their difficulty in finding the labor that they need. And it raises a profound question of whether this is the right time, if there's ever a right time, to be talking about mass deportations.
You know, Apple has come out with their newest iPhone this week, which I must say I'm interested to take a good look at. You have written that it was actually Steve Jobs himself who gave us this present. Talk about what you mean.
Yeah, it's a kind of a, you know, catchy headline, but what I mean is that the smartphone and everything that implies, which is so enormous, the idea that each individual person now possesses the means of mass communication, both video and text communication with people all around the world, it's as transformative as the Gutenberg revolution of movable type was in the 15th century. And you think about the follow-on effects of Gutenberg and the printing press, you start talking about world-shaking events like the Reformation, like the Enlightenment, like the Scientific Revolution, the Industrial Revolution. All those things happened because of print, because people were able to communicate across space and time. Now, there's no mediators, there's no publishers involved anymore, there's no editors involved anymore. It's each individual person, radical democracy. And Donald Trump understood that at a visceral level better than anyone we've seen in our politics. He went around not only the press, but around the leadership of the Republican Party to connect directly with an audience that he's been building over the years through TV and other kinds of media. He used Twitter, continues to, Facebook, all these social networking tools to completely upend our traditional politics. And I see no reason to think that he'll be the last to be able to do that. I think that 2016 is going to be recognized as, you know, transforming our political process. I hope ultimately for the better, but that's going to be up to all these all of us individuals with the, you know, tools in our, literally the palms of our hands.
But I wonder if you think that there is going to be some attempt to crack down on Facebook and Twitter to take a far greater role in what kind of information can be shared and with whom. We've heard from Ben Smith, the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, who talks about Facebook really easing out of the business of, quote, bland background statements and awkward photo ops, and to start worrying about congressional testimony. I mean, yeah. you've got this idea that somehow these are the new AT&Ts that have to be broken up in order to maintain some order along the route.
Clearly, that's the next enormous discussion that we're headed into in the area of technology. These Facebook, Google, the other, you know, Twitter, the enormous intersections of our social mediated lives. They started out as thinking of themselves just as platforms, and they've clearly become something much larger than platforms, and they've become institutions in themselves, and they are going to have to start behaving with the responsibility of institutions. Maybe they need to be broken up. That is certainly a discussion that's going to be hotter and hotter. My question is, if you break them up into a lot of little pieces, is that going to make things better, worse? The fragmentation of our culture, the ability of people to retreat into their niche communities and not encounter any other ideas, that's already a problem. And perhaps... perhaps Facebook is, you know, the last remaining common space we have.
And yet, the most potentially intrusive into yes. our lives in ways that even we do not fully understand. So it'll be fascinating to see what happens. Many people are saying that this is one of the most underappreciated trends, reshaping politics and techs and business. But you are still, I gather, optimistic because you say younger Americans seem better prepared. What does that mean?
To me, the only answer to this is a more aware and more active consumption of news and information and communication. People who understand that you have to know where stuff is coming from. You have to that the curating, if you will, of information. It's not being done by editors and publishers anymore, so it's got to be done by the consumers themselves. That doesn't come naturally, Diane, to our generation, because we grew up in a world where our information was curated by powerful and generally responsible organization, just a handful of them, three TV networks and a handful of dominant print news sources. So I think that is going to take people who have never known anything else. You know, I talk to people all the time in my age group who will tell me something, and I'll say, why do you think that's true? And they'll say, well, I heard it on TV. Hmm. They're accustomed to thinking that everything that is on TV has gone through some sort of vetting process by people who are trying to get, you know, at least partially at the truth. It's like they've been dropped down in a foreign country and don't speak the language.
But you argue that the younger generation may not be quite so polarized as the baby boomers.
I hope that's true. You know, you look on the college campuses and you can question that at some of these places where they're having trouble with free speech and that sort of thing. But my own kids who are in their teenage years now, there are so many of the issues that drove the baby boomers apart that they don't care about or find divisive at all, the issues, you know, all the issues around sexuality, from abortion to homosexuality. They're much more inclusive about race and religion than the baby boomers were. So you see these, you know, what we've called wedge issues for our whole careers, right? That these younger generation kids, the millennials and younger, they have no interest in them. They
right.
just shake their heads and it's like we're speaking Swahili to them.
Well, I'm glad you're optimistic. I think our country needs some optimism, and I'm glad to have had the chance to talk with you, David Vondrelli. Thank you so much for being with us on the podcast, On My Mind.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Diane.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, a quick break, and we're back. Now, here's Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health. He's a physician and geneticist and has led the NIH since 2009. Dr. Collins, it's so great to see you again.
Diane, it's great to be on your podcast.
Thank you. A lot has happened with the new administration in office. The new president has proposed that the NIH budget be slashed by some 22%. But members of Congress have a different idea. Tell us what's happening.
Well, first of all, I didn't expect to still be the NIH director here now, well
really?
Into this next administration. Oh, historically, there's never been an NIH director who was carried over after a change of administration. So I was fully prepared on January 20th to do something else and thought that would be kind of interesting to explore the next chapter without quite knowing what it would be. But was surprised on January 18th to get a notice from the White House saying that my resignation letter had been rejected.
How wonderful for us and the country.
Well, I first wondered, was the grammar incorrect? Was there something wrong with the punctuation? What happened here? But apparently it was a little more than that. Although it was then several months after that of being unclear about, did they just want somebody to keep the seat warm or did they really want me to play the role of the director? And by June, then the president said, yes, I want Collins to do the job, not just sort of be a caretaker. So I'm doing the job.
And good.
And I'm privileged to do so and delighted to have a chance to continue to try to steer this amazing ship of biomedical research and discovery, because it's just phenomenal time and phenomenal people to work with and a noble enterprise.
At the same time, proposed 22% cut.
Well, that was a little hard to look at and
feel kind
of concerned about where this was going. As you've said, the Congress has had a different idea, and certainly for fiscal year 17, where we didn't actually get a budget until April, they came forward then with a very gratifying decision, the second year in a row to give NIH a $2 billion increase. And now here we are looking at fiscal year 18, where they clearly have a different idea than the administration, and Senator Roy Blunt, as the chair of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee, did the markup just recently, and again, put down a $2 billion increment for NIH. That would be a hat trick. That'd be 3 years in a row of the Congress proposing to get us back on a stable trajectory, which would be so much better than the roller coaster that we've had to live with for the last 15 years. So I'm feeling excited and energized. And I think the Trump administration is coming around to the idea that this is actually a good investment for governments to make, and something that they might potentially want to give more support to as they think about the future.
And the Congress has also rejected the president's proposal to eliminate NIH's work with other countries to fight global diseases around the world.
The Fogarty International Center, which is what you're referring to, is one of our 27 institutes and centers. It's about to celebrate its 50th year. And when you look at what their contributions have been to health around the world, it's phenomenal. And, of course, we all recognize that diseases don't recognize country boundaries. There's some amazing stories that one can look at. When the Ebola crisis happened, who were the individuals in West Africa who were on the front lines that kept that from getting worse than it would have been? They were all former trainees of the Fogarty Center. When you look at ministers of health around the world, especially in low and middle income countries, a lot of them were former Fogarty fellows. It's created this wonderful network where we know each other, we know how to work together, and in a crisis like Ebola or whatever the next one is going to be, and there probably will be a next one, that matters a lot. So I think Fogarty has been a very modest investment. It's the smallest of all our institutes, but it's paid off in a big way.
You talk about all your institutes. I'm not sure the American people understand the totality of how NIH actually operates. Give us a sort of overview.
Whenever I have to show my organizational chart to somebody who hasn't seen it before, they always look a little overwhelmed because here's the director's office and then here are 27 institutes and centers.
27.
It's the kind of structure that only the Congress could have designed. So each one of those institutes focuses on a particular area of research. So there's an institute that studies cancer, the National Cancer Institute. There's one that studies infectious disease. Tony Fauci is the director of that, somebody you know well. There's one on diabetes. There's one on heart, lung, and blood disease. Some of them don't actually focus on specific diseases, but more on organ systems. There's an eye institute, for instance. It actually works really well.
But how is the money distributed among those 27 institutes?
By the Congress. So when we get our appropriation every year, each one of those 27 institutes has a line item budget
that goes
to that institute for them to figure out how to use. Now, there are some places where we can figure out ways to work together that I think are pretty exciting. Something called the Common Fund, which was put in place 10 years ago by Congress, which I'm a big fan of. And that's $500 million for projects that don't fit neatly into any one of those institutes, but if they were successful, would have a huge impact on everything. Take, for example, our study of the microbiome, all of those organisms that live on us and in us that could affect everything from diabetes to heart disease to obesity to Crohn's disease, all of these things that people want to know more about. That's a perfect Common Fund project. We've invested a lot in that. It's lifted all the boats with this kind of scientific knowledge.
Give me an idea of what's happening with, for example, Alzheimer's disease. That is something that I've been very much involved with. And I just wonder whether the Congress has finally come to recognize, looking forward, what an impact that disease is going to have on our country.
Yes, they have come to that realization in a very big way in the last few years. And as you say, the impact is daunting when you consider it's already daunting with 5 million people affected, costing this year something in the neighborhood of $250 billion for the care and also the caregivers. And that's going to go up to perhaps $1 trillion by 2050 if we don't come up with a way to prevent or at least delay the onset of this. Congress gets that, both because of the economic cost, but more because of the tragedy in individual lives. So they have been ramping up the support for that at NIH more dramatically than anything in a long time. The proposal in the Senate markup is now $1.8 billion for Alzheimer's disease research. It was less than a third of that 5 years ago. So this is like an incredibly steep ramp up. And we're grateful for that. And we have lots of ways to spend that money wisely. The other thing that I think we're doing now, which didn't happen until recently, is working more closely with industry in a partnership where the industry scientists and the academic scientists sit around the same table, work on the things that you could call pre-competitive. Industry pays half the cost. We pay half the cost. All the data is made accessible immediately to everybody. Just saying, this is too important to have it hidden behind curtains. We've got to work on this together.
Give me an idea of the comparison of the money going to Alzheimer's and the money going to cancer research.
It's always a little hard to say exactly where the boundaries are. When you talk about cancer research, the National Cancer Institute has a budget of about $5 billion a year. But that covers a lot of very basic science that is just trying to understand what makes cells decide to grow and when they stop growing, because that's sort of relevant to cancer. Some of it's studying the genome and understanding what happens, how do you make mistakes copying DNA, because that's very much what causes cancer. So of that $5 billion, perhaps 40% of it, you could say, well, that's directly cancer research, and the rest is undergirding. So that means we're getting pretty close in terms of total investments between Alzheimer's and cancer. Alzheimer's still a little behind, but not that much.
And you see that increasing as we go forward.
I think the proposal to get Alzheimer's up into the right place is getting very close to being true. And, of course, what we have to figure out exactly is what are the scientific opportunities and are we matching them? Are there great ideas for Alzheimer's that are going unfunded? There certainly were 5 years ago. There are fewer now, but there are still some. Exactly where do you hit the right level? Without, of course, getting so focused that you forget that oftentimes the big breakthrough for a disease comes from where you didn't expect it. I still think it's possible that the next thing that we need to know about Alzheimer's disease won't be funded by that $1.8 billion that's called Alzheimer's. It'll come from some basic scientist who's studying the brain.
Interesting. Bring us up to date on the gene editing technique known as CRISPR.
I'd love to. I'm very excited about this. This came out of an unprecedented kind of basic science initiative that nobody thought was going to be relevant to human health. And what do you know? It's a great story of that sort. This was discovered on the basis of trying to understand how bacteria fight off the viruses that affect them, because they have viruses too. And it turns out they have this elegant system for recognizing the DNA sequence of an invading virus and snipping it and basically inactivating that virus. How do they do that? Well, they have this enzyme called Cas9, the most famous one. And you give that enzyme some sort of a template to tell it what to look for, and it will go and find that DNA sequence in an incredibly complicated mix and snip it just like that. And it's That's how many bacteria survive the onslaught of viruses that are all around them. What was figured out by people like Jennifer Doudna and Feng Zhang independently was that this kind of approach would not just work for bacteria. It would work for any cells. If you provided them with the Cas9 enzyme and you provided them with a short stretch of an RNA, a guide RNA, that would go and find a place in a human genome and make a change in it and not really mess with the rest of it. So it's very precise. The off-target problem, which has been a big issue for modifying DNA, doesn't seem to be near as big a deal with CRISPR-Cas. So I'll tell you, one of the reasons I'm excited about this is there are 7,000 genetic diseases. We know for those diseases exactly what's wrong at the DNA level. We've discovered all of that, mostly in the last 20 years, and a lot of it because of the Genome Project. Only 500 of those have treatments. We now, at least theoretically, have a way to go and fix those genetic problems. For some of them, the ones that we could go after first, you could actually do this in a way where you would take cells out of the body, fix them, and put them back. My most passionate sense here about what we could do is to cure sickle cell disease, the first molecular disease affecting tens of thousands of people in the U.S. and millions elsewhere. Single letter out of place in the beta globin gene on chromosome 11 that should have been an A and it's a T. CRISPR-Cas has already been shown to be really good at finding that and fixing it, in growing in a laboratory dish. So here's the idea. Take a bone marrow sample from somebody with sickle cell disease, find those stem cells that make red blood cells, apply CRISPR-Cas in just the right way, fix that sickle mutation, and then give those cells back to that person after you've sort of made space for it in their bone marrow so the cells can take up residence. Bam, if everything goes the way it should,
wow.
That's not just a treatment. That's a cure. That's going to last.
Wow.
I think we could do that in 5 years.
And you're talking about that being done with an individual already into adulthood?
Oh, yes. And we'd probably start with people and adults because obviously there will be unknowns here, and you have to be sure when you're doing this kind of research that the benefits and the risks are explained. And starting with children is generally not the way to go. But for adults, many of whom have gone through a lifetime of incredible pain and suffering because sickle cell is an awful disease to have to live with, we could offer something unprecedented.
What about something like Fragile X disease? Would CRISPR help there?
It's a great question. It theoretically could. The question is the timing. So Fragile X is caused by one of these triplet mutations that's expanded. Let me explain that. So in Fragile X, you have a series of letters that are CCG, CCG, CCG. And most of us have a limited a number of those repeats. But in Fragile X, the repeats expand to hundreds or even thousands of copies of that. And it kind of makes the gene right there go to sleep because there's all this noise next to it. And that causes this common cause of learning disability, which is particularly serious in males because it's on the X chromosome. And males only have one X, so there's nothing to balance it. You could imagine, and undoubtedly this is going to be possible, to use CRISPR-Cas to basically clip out all of those excess repeats.
Huh.
But you would have to, if you wanted to use this to prevent or treat the disease, do it early enough that you could result in normal brain development. I'm not sure what happens if you wait till somebody's 20 years old and then try to do this. And let me not oversimplify. To do this for Fragile X, you have to have a delivery system that takes that CRISPR-Cas system to the right cells in the brain.
Of course.
That's hard. I used the example of sickle cell disease because you can take the cells out and treat them and put them back. You can't do that with the brain. We have to come up with delivery systems for many of these genetic diseases that gets all the mechanics you need to do the gene editing to go to the right cells at the right time safely. And that's a big challenge. I don't want to oversimplify what's in front of us.
Have you been doing this kind of thinking since you were a little boy? Really? I mean, imagining the possibilities.
I think maybe imagining, but not in biological ways. I thought biology was a very uninteresting science when I was a kid. I was interested in chemistry and physics and mathematics, and biology was way too messy. It never seemed like an area that had much interest because I just thought of it as descriptive. I didn't realize growing up, even by the time I was in college, I avoided biology.
And when did you make the conversion?
It was very significant as a graduate student at Yale. I was studying quantum mechanics, getting my PhD in physical chemistry. But in that same department was a laboratory that was studying DNA, the chemistry of DNA. And I was one of those graduate students who worked at 2 o'clock in the morning, and so I would take a break and talk to the other people who were there at that hour. And I started learning about the idea that biology made sense. There was this thing called DNA. It was an information molecule. It was digital. It was mathematical. It's like, oh, my gosh, I missed out. And it also became really clear that we were on the brink of where this would no longer just be an academic kind of study. This was going to change everything for our understanding of the human body and for medicine. And I wanted to be part of that. So I made a big change and left my physical chemistry behind and went to medical school.
Well, we are very fortunate because you are the one who has come out with mapping the genome.
Yeah.
And here we are now. I want to go back to CRISPR for one reason, and that is how much better, theoretically, could gene editing with CRISPR be compared to using IVF to select embryos?
So that's where the ethical questions quickly arise, and they should. So what you're speaking about, people are wondering, could you use gene editing not on bone marrow cells, but actually on embryos? Could you change the entire genome and then create a child whose genome has been edited by human intervention? That would be unprecedented. I must tell you, I have deep concerns about crossing that line because we probably don't always know exactly what the consequences would be. And even from philosophical and theological perspectives, have we moved into a space that is traditionally off limits for ourselves in terms of modifying our entire species. People have said, well, that's fine, but what about to treat a terrible disease? Wouldn't it be more moral and more ethical to take the technology and avoid the birth of a child with a terrible disease like Tay-Sachs disease or cystic fibrosis? But here's where I think the arguments fall a little flat, because the way you would do this, as you've just mentioned, involves IVF, in vitro fertilization. If you were going to, say, try to modify an embryo to keep it from having cystic fibrosis, you'd have to know that there was a risk, which means you already know both parents carry this gene. That means that one out of four of their embryos would be affected. Well, in order to know which ones, you'd have to do in vitro fertilization. You can do then a DNA test on each embryo, believe it or not, without destroying the embryo, and you can figure out which ones are affected. But that means there are going to be several that aren't affected as well. So why would you then say it's more ethical to use this uncertain new kind of technology to fix the one embryo that maybe you found that's going to be affected and implant that one? Why don't you just implant the ones that you have already proven are not going to be affected? This is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It's well established. If the parents are interested in having an unaffected child, we can do that. We don't need CRISPR-Cas gene editing to do so. People can come up with rare circumstances where there wouldn't be any normal embryos, but it's pretty hard to see how that happens. So I, for one, think we got to really think hard about crossing that line into using this technology for that purpose. I'm all in favor of using it to treat people who already have a genetic disease in a way that doesn't modify the DNA that's going to get passed to the next generation. But to do this in what we call the germline, modifying an embryo, let's think hard about that.
Now, what about laboratories across the country? Hmm. Are there rules and regulations about non-governmental funding for that sort of thing?
There is no real enforcement of such rules and regulations. There are sort of principles. The National Academy of Sciences has put out a report recently in the last 3 months or so, which actually did leave the door open a little bit to embryo modification by gene editing, but in very specific circumstances. And people look at that as a framework, I suppose, of what's considered ethical. As you say, NIH cannot support this. We are legally prohibited from doing any research on a human embryo because of something called the Dickey Wicker Amendment, which has been around for 20 years.
Dr. Cutlins, you and I could talk for hours.
Yes, we could.
I know.
It would be fun, too.
But there is now regenerative medicine. Can you talk about what that is all about?
Well, this is another area of enormous excitement and sort of came out of an area that most of us didn't expect would be possible. It's just now 10 years ago that Shinya Yamanaka was able to show that you could take skin cells from a normal human being, and you could convince them to go back in time and become what you call pluripotent, that is, capable of becoming any kind of cell in the body. That was breathtaking. There are a few times when I have read a paper in the scientific literature and literally gotten chills, but that was
really,
I remember the moment reading that because it was transformative. Nobody thought that would be possible. It was sort of like when you get to be a skin cell, you're like done. You're not going to go back and become pluripotent. But with these four genes that Yamanaka identified, you reprogram the whole system. That opens up this enormous possibility for regenerative medicine for each of us, because potentially our bodies have the potential to come up with solutions to things that we might need help for.
Give me a specific example.
Yeah, I would. Well, for instance, let's take the circumstance of heart disease. We all know that we're doing better in managing heart disease. Deaths from heart attack are way down, but there's still way too many people who end up with congestive heart failure, where ultimately the muscle in the heart is just really worn out. And there aren't enough heart transplants to actually take the place of that. And way too many people die of sort of end-stage congestive heart failure. But if your own body were capable of making your own heart...
A new heart?
This is probably a 10-year horizon, but okay. The cells, we've already been able to do this. You can take your skin cells, turn them back into these so-called induced pluripotent cells, and then add the right cocktail and turn them into beating heart cells. You can see them beating in the laboratory.
My
dish.
Goodness.
So now what you need is a scaffold to sort of build them into the right structure and some other nuances in terms of having the appropriate arterial supply, which people are working on. And maybe with a time involvement, but this is a chronic illness, you'd have a little time to build your own heart when it looked like you would need one.
My mouth is gaping wide open.
I'm taking the regenerative medicine longer view. There are things we can do that are perhaps more available now. We're doing right now a clinical trial to see whether for people who have macular degeneration, which is the most common cause of adult blindness, could they actually make new retinal cells for the eyes that are failing them using this same approach? Make these pluripotent stem cells from yourself, differentiate them into the right kind of cells that your eye needs, inject them in there. It's looking like that could work in a matter of a few years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Really? Wow. And the other thing that I am wowing about these days is immunotherapy.
Oh, yeah.
Because several of my personal friends have experienced this and have, with certain kinds of cancer, had immunotherapy really work. Talk about what it means.
Oh, it's incredibly exciting.
So exciting.
And goodness knows, we've desperately needed new ideas about how to help people whose cancers have already spread outside of the original site, so-called metastatic disease, because in the past, that's kind of been something you might be able to manage, but you would rarely expect to see it cured. And immunotherapy now is breaking all those rules in a wonderful way. People have worked on immunotherapy for a long time. Steve Rosenberg here at NIH 40 years ago started down this path. And for most of those 40 years, everybody said, Steve, you're wasting your time. It's never going to work. And he would occasionally get a response from somebody with melanoma, which was the disease he primarily studied. But most of the time, it would fail. But he kept at it and gradually, bit by bit, began to figure out, with advances in understanding the immune system, understanding what cancer is all about, putting things together, getting other people engaged in this field. It's now the hottest thing in cancer
what
research.
Is it?
Well,
help us to understand it.
Well, your immune system is designed to survey what's going on in your body every moment of every day and say, is there something here that doesn't belong? And it's looking, of course, for infections, viruses, and bacteria. But it's also looking for your own cells that have gone bad and are going down that path toward cancer, making an abnormal protein that they recognize as that's not self, and they go after it. And some people would say probably all of us are getting cancer every day, but we never know about it because the immune system discovers it quickly and gets rid of those bad cells. But cancers can be very clever. And the ones that are successful figure out how to disguise themselves. And they send this message to the immune system saying, nothing to see here, just move on. And then they grow and grow and grow. And then their diagnosis is made. And oftentimes the chemotherapy that we give is insufficient. And then you end up in a terrible circumstance. But the immune system's still there. It's just gone to sleep. So immunotherapy is, how do you wake the immune system up? And there are a couple of ways of doing that that are really dramatic. One is with a drug called a checkpoint inhibitor, which basically gets into the mechanics of how that cancer told the immune system to go to sleep and wrecks it. So the immune system wakes up and goes, oh my gosh, look over there. We got to get busy. And they do. And Jimmy Carter, you this amazing story of our former president with melanoma, metastatic to his brain, announcing that 2 years ago, he's doing great because of a checkpoint inhibitor.
Remarkably.
That worked perfectly in his situation. Now, those don't always work. The other way to do this, which is even more high tech, is to basically take the immune system cells out of the body and take them to school, basically teach them what they should be looking for because they don't seem to have recognized it. And that's the CAR T-cell approach, which was just approved by FDA in Novartis' application for leukemia. That is very complicated to imagine how you're going to scale it to millions of people. But when it works, it is dramatic. And what happens? You give these retrained cells back, and a big battle goes on, and people get very sick for 2 or 3 days. They might be in the ICU with everything seemed to go wrong. But then they get through that, and the cancer's gone. And it doesn't come back.
Another wow.
Yeah, that's a wow.
People must love having dinner with you. You've got so many stories to tell.
I love telling stories.
Dr. Collins, thank you so much for being here today. It was great to talk with you.
I'll come back anytime, Diane. It's
okay.
Great to talk to you.
Wonderful. Thank you. And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email to drpodcast@wamu.org or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851 or go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden. Comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Our engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.